The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. And we are reading from the Oprah Quarterly Published Magazine. The first article is called, What's Beautiful to You? A Renaissance painting? A flawless double axle? Yes, of course. But also, perhaps, a small or curious or simple thing only you can appreciate. On the pages to come, behold the proof that, if you are willing to take the time and really look, beauty is all around you. The Beaten Path. The dirt road of her childhood still stretches vivid and imperfect into the horizon of Crystal Ponte's mind. Please don't let that bust a hole in the muffler. My mother would appeal to the Lord as gravel pelted the underbelly of our 1978 Lincoln Continental. It's been decades, but I can still hear those tinging rocks. Sometimes, like a strike on a bass drum, a larger stone would spin up into the gut of the car, and we'd gasp, then giggle, relieved when the motorized beast kept right on humming. Only 6 or 7 houses and a few farms sat on our 3-mile dirt road, each separated by wide swaths of empty land. Our house was in the center, atop the only hill. The road, its contours hugging field and forest, ran through my hometown of Durham, Maine. Rain turned the top layer into a coating of thick muck, which gave life to the world's best bakery. I'd spend hours making mud pies on the shoulder. When dry grass grew in the road's ruts, I'd hop barefoot between the verdant patches, bypassing a minefield of rocks to play with my friend who lived around the bend. The rare car would barrel past, vibrating the earth, and I'd take cover in the ditch, pitching toes into the dirt thrown there, its texture gritty as powdered malt. Some people see angels in clouds, but I beheld shapes in the dust plume behind our taillights. When it was hot, the ground dried out, forming canyons. It looked as if the earth were separating. In winter, snow hid the road, and even when it was plowed, you had to guess at its curves, splitting the distance between trees to find the way forward. In time, the town became a hotbed of development. Families moved in, houses were built. Progress demanded change. It's been 34 years since my childhood road. My childhood was sealed under hot tar. I think about it sometimes, still alive under there, still itself. Maybe some prefer manicured streets, but there was a sweetness to all those wild bumps. Time has not dimmed my memories of how the road followed us inside, its dirt clinging to our souls, filling our house with a dry aroma and a veil of caramel-hued soot. I drew hearts in the dust on our windows, looking through them at the path we took to the world and home again. Beauty Mark. Small, useful, and perennially misused, the comma is exquisite to Arid Hamburger. My late father used to judge restaurants by their bread baskets. His reasonings? If you can't get the little things right, how can you be trusted with a filet mignon? I feel that way about commas. One sign that something has gone amiss in a piece of writing is the sight of the punctuative curlicue scattered haphazardly around the page like sprinkles tossed on a cupcake. My writing students often deploy them by intuition, sometimes using the breath method, inserting a comma whenever they might pause between words to take in air. Then again, another sign of prose gone awry is the opposite scenario, a comma desert, no pauses to be found. I always feel a bit disappointed, even sad, when I see the innocent comma abused in these ways, because such abuses indicate that my students don't grasp the utility of this exquisitely subtle mark. They prefer the melodramatic exclamation point in part because it's harder to misuse. But commas are essential and lovely in their retiring way. They're like the fine stitches along the seams of an expertly sewn garment, invisible yet vital to holding the pieces together. Commas separate ideas. They indicate logical relationships. In dialogue, commas can mean life or death. Kill ducks versus kill ducks. The first kill ducks has 2 quotes and an exclamation point, versus kill, comma, ducks. Their absence or presence creates or destroys a line's poetry. Imagine an emotional scene set in a come in a, quote, cool blue room, quote, versus a, quote, cool blue room, comma, quote. The latter like an inane compliment. Quote, hey, cool blue room, you got there? Then again, I shouldn't judge my students so harshly. I, too, failed to appreciate the quiet dignity of the comma until in graduate school I taught composition to first-year students. I remember the program had a firm, white-haired woman fixing me in her gaze and saying, you have no idea where the commas go or why. I felt faint. How could I have misunderstood something so basic? Well, the thing is, commas aren't so basic, and learning to use them to their full potential, prudently, carefully, with an eye toward clarity and rhythm, takes years. Oscar Wilde once joked about what a hard day of writing entailed. Spending the morning taking out a comma, and in the afternoon, on mature reflection, putting it back in. That sounds about right. The way he wears his sundress. Julie Clam's son has perfected his personal style, glam, eye-catching, entirely his own. From age 2 to 4, Violet wore a sequined tank top emblazoned with a star, plus a diaphanous tutu and chartreuse fairy wings, accessorized with a beribboned wand and a silver crown. At 9, Violet wore a large-brimmed Halloween witch's hat all summer. It was preferable to wearing sunscreen. I've always been envious of Violet's style, all that color and confidence. When Violet came out as a transgender male at 13, I wondered how that glorious self-expression would change. Would I be losing a daughter, saying farewell to the glitz, the sparkling wings and wands, and going and gaining a son? Would Violet's fanciful fashion give way to a uniform of sports jerseys and cargo shorts? As it turned out, I didn't get a new child. I got the same one, but with a new aesthetic. A little bit girl, a little bit boy, and still a whole lot of wow. Not long after coming out, Violet, the name he's kept, cut his waist-length hair to the chin, with long bangs falling into his face. He wears a binder, a chest-flattening undergarment, and most days a Talking Heads t-shirt and jeans. But if he feels like donning a rhinestone choker or a ruffled pink skirt or fishnet stockings or crimson eyeshadow, he does. To the New York City Pride Parade, he wore homemade rainbow angel wings. So many wings. Over a yellow t-shirt that says, gay, in red letters, plus a gingham belt. And yet, no matter how many times his great aunt begs him to shave his legs, he says firmly, no, I'm a boy. When a friend of mine came into town recently, I was worried. She and I had long treated her very girly daughter and Violet to manicures and ladies' lunch. I started coming up with a list of gender-neutral activities. We could roller skate, go to a museum bowl. But on the day of the visit, Violet came out of his room and made two declarations. He'd be going with a sparkly gold polish for his manicure, and he'd be ordering the macaroni and cheese at lunch. The pair spent the day just as they always had, though on the subway afterward I did notice that Violet was guilty of a little man-spreading. No, 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 I said, you can be a boy, not a bro. In every way that he interacts with the world, my son embraces all that is masculine, feminine, fantastical, and fancy. The other morning he left for school in a bright floral sundress, hot pink Doc Martens, and a jean jacket he'd hand-painted. On the way back are two Keith Haring figures holding a big rainbow heart. The net result was, as it always is, a stunning melange, an ever-evolving swirl, free from the confines of anyone else's idea of beauty or boyness or girlness of being. Line dancing. Sasha Sagan admires the orderly splendor of rush hour traffic. I have a childhood memory of standing at a hotel window, gazing down at a metropolis at rush hour. The sun had set. The city, Chicago, I think, was lit up. The cars with white lights are coming this way, I told my parents, and the red lights go that way. I was delighted by this display of precision, these tidy lines of cars weaving between skyscrapers. It didn't seem like the work of humans, but part of some biological telepathy, like blood cells, schools of fish, or flocks of birds. For the drivers, it was surely ordinary, even torturous, but from my vantage, it was a ballet performed by strangers joined by an invisible force. I still marvel at it. Yes, people forget to signal, and accidents happen daily, but by and large, we obey the lines and lights. How lovely, how indicative of our trust and order in each other, that stripes on the ground, rare enough to keep us from colliding. From my kitchen, I can see the highway leading out of Boston by 4:45 p.m. It's bumper to bumper. I know people are miserable out there, but I'm reassured by the sight, everyone bowing to something greater than themselves. Traffic is evidence that even when the world feels chaotic, we're still abiding by these fragile parameters, still accountable to one another, inching forward together. Moving over to a recipe, salad for days. This dish has enough substance and kick to be a standalone lunch or part of a mezze spread, says the chef. If you can't find black radish, just use double the number of red. Lentil and pickled chalet salad with Burberry croutons. The ingredients for the lentil salad are 10.5 ounces of puy, P-U-Y, lentils, 10 ounces banana or regular shallots, 8 to 12 depending on the size and type, thinly sliced, 5 tablespoons of olive oil divided, flaking salt and pepper, 2 tablespoons of sherry vinegar, 8 ounces sourdough bread crust discarded, torn into quarter-inch pieces, 1.5 teaspoons of Burberry for 1 teaspoon hot smoked paprika, 1.25 cups of cilantro leaves, 1 cup of baby arugula roughly chopped, 1 golden beet about 5 ounces scrubbed, halved, and thinly sliced, and half a large black radish scrubbed, halved, and thinly sliced, and 10 small radishes scrubbed and thinly sliced. For the dressing, it's a tablespoon of sherry vinegar, 1 tablespoon of fresh lemon juice, 1.5 teaspoons of Dijon mustard, 1.5 teaspoons of orange blossom honey for other floral variety, or any other floral variety, 3 tablespoons of olive oil, and flaky salt and pepper. Make the lentil salad. Rinse lentils and place in a medium saucepan. Cover with water and bring to a boil. Reduce heat and simmer until just barely tender. They should still retain a bite. It takes 15 to 20 minutes. Drain, rinse under cold water to cool, then spread on a clean towel to dry. Number 2. Heat your oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit and line a rimmed baking sheet with parchment paper. In a bowl, toss the shallots with 3 tablespoons of oil and half a teaspoon of salt. Arrange on prepared sheet and bake until tender, but not at all brown, about 12 minutes. Transfer the shallots to the bowl and add the vinegar and mix to combine and let cool. Number 3. In a medium bowl, toss sourdough with remaining 2 tablespoons of oil, then Burberry to coat. Arrange on second parchment paper-lined baking sheet and bake along with the shallots until lightly golden brown and crisp, 12 to 15 minutes, and let it cool. Number 4. Meanwhile, make dressing. In a small bowl, whisk together vinegar, lemon juice, Dijon, and honey. Then whisk in oil, half a teaspoon of salt and pepper, adjusting salt as desired, and set aside. When ready to serve in a large bowl, toss lentils, shallots, cilantro, arugula, beets, radishes, and half of croutons with dressing. Transfer to a platter and sprinkle with remaining croutons. Our next article is Chatting with Anne Napolitano, the inside scoop on Hello Beautiful from Oprah's Book Club's 100th author. Number 1. What were you doing when Oprah called? I was taking out the garbage. I was holding a garbage bag in one hand, standing next to the mailboxes in the lobby of my apartment building when I answered the phone. The call screen said Chicago, so I thought it might be my uncle who lives there. When the voice said, "Hi, Anne, this is Oprah Winfrey," my first thought was that it was one of those smart telemarketing recordings like when Bill Clinton uses your name and asks you to vote for a particular candidate. But the voice also sounded real, so I replied dumbly, "Oprah Winfrey? Oprah Winfrey?" Once it was clear that it really was Oprah and she was telling me that she loved my book, it became an out-of-body experience. I still can't believe she called me. I never took a step or even put down the garbage bag because I was afraid that if I moved, the cell reception might drop out and Oprah and this amazing conversation would disappear. Number 2. What book most inspired Hello Beautiful? I wasn't aware of a book inspiring Hello Beautiful until I was well into the first draft, and the Potavano sisters started to compare themselves to the sisters from Little Women. Once this happened, I couldn't believe I hadn't seen the connection earlier. I had created a family of 4 strong sisters who were incredibly close and a lonely young man who enters their family. The similarities to the March sisters and Lori were there. I just hadn't seen them. I'm often surprised when I write. My work is usually wiser than I am. Little Women was one of my favorite books growing up, and it clearly never left me. Number 3, what was the hardest thing about writing this book, and what was the most fun? The most challenging aspect of writing this book was how deeply I cared, almost immediately, about the story and these characters. Instead of walking in slowly and getting a feel for the story and making choices, it felt like I was dropped into the ocean and I had to flail my arms wildly to stay afloat. It felt so important, almost life or death, that I get the character stories right. The idea that I might not go deep enough or that I might miss a truth worried me at all the time. The fictional world of the Potavano sisters and Pilsen and William lived inside me, and I was feverish with it until I felt that I'd done the characters justice. The most fun part for me was being with the four sisters. I started this book at the beginning of the pandemic, and my father had just died. In a way, I entered this book lonely like William. I was craving connection and vitality, and the four girls embodied those qualities when they were in the same room. I loved them immediately, and that love nourished not only William, but me too. Number 4. What advice do you have for writers out there? I'm talking about average people who are out there writing, finding success not in their youth. 2 things. Number 1, write as often as you can. Even if you can only manage 5 minutes of writing a day, do that. The more stories you write and the more characters you create, the stronger your feel for your strengths and weaknesses will be. There's a wonderful Isaac Dinesen quote, "Write a little every day without hope and without despair." Number 2, find a reader or readers who will be kind and tell you the truth about your work. No matter how talented or experienced you are, you need another pair of eyes to tell you what you're doing badly and what you're doing well. You're in the river with the work, and you need someone on the bank of the river to call out, "Head left, there's a waterfall up ahead, slow down here," etc. Two writers I went to graduate school with, Helen Ellis and Hannah Tinty, check out their amazing books, are my first and best readers, but perhaps your partner or sister or lawyer friend might be the perfect reader for you. Heading back over to the What's Beautiful to You stories. Slowing down, Howard Axelrod extols the slow, strange loveliness of the lowly gastropod. In 1994, during a pickup basketball game at Harvard, I was permanently blinded in my right eye. There was a stray ball, the feeling of bodies too close, and then of a boy's finger hooking into my eye past the knuckle. The fingernail sheared my optic nerve, the cable that connects the eyeball to the brain. I lost peripheral vision, depth perception, and almost a sense of firmness in the world. Afterward, I tripped often on stairs, spilled glasses of juice in the dining hall, and sometimes crashed into people on my right who seemed to have materialized out of thin air. Instead of going to breakfast, I began to watch the morning from my bedroom window, the shifting patterns of students walking to class. I became afraid that the world would always look unfinished now, every line just the ghost of a line, as though everything had already happened somewhere else without me. I became afraid that some larger truth would remain forever invisible. Not long after graduation, I went to live in solitude in the woods of Vermont. I wanted the world to look solid again, and I wanted to feel solid in it. And there I encountered, in some ways, for the first time, the snail. Snails are slimy, almost faceless creatures, like internal organs on the loose, vainly attempting to disguise themselves with a shell. But there's something about them that is beautiful. That first November, they emerged after the rains, inching along rotting logs and unsuspecting leaves, an invertebrate invasion as a kind of test. I began to kneel down in the long grass and watch them. I wanted to see if I could match my attention literally to a snail's pace, if I could watch and not lose patience. My hope was that by learning to see slowly, I would learn to see more. Gradually, my senses adapted. I'd notice a blue-gray stippled body as it trailed its glinting slime across a leaf, gently canting this way and that like a ship, or the way a snail seemed to eat by whispering, as though casting a spell into the leaf. Or more surprising, I'd hear the papery wing beats of a crow overhead, or see a squirrel yawn on a branch. Each snail was a doorway to the beauty existing around me. As fall deepened into winter, the snail's slowness carried into another part of my day. Stepping outside into the trackless white after a nor'easter, taking in the path of the wind by the snowdrifts on the trees, snowshoeing up into the woods, hearing a chickadee, and letting my eyes go soft to wait for movement in the branches, even talking to a friend on the phone and picturing what he'd said, imagining him by the stone wall rimming Central Park and seeing him as clearly as a movie. It's not that lines looked solid again, even in my mind's eye, but to have lost my sense of fixity in the world, which is really just a construction of the brain, and anyway, no longer unsettled me. It wasn't that I felt I was suddenly seeing again. Rather, I felt seen myself, included in existence. Missing out on some greater truth was impossible, because I felt a part of what was true. Sweet and lowbrow. Who can take a starburst, see it as a gem? The Candy Woman, a.k.a. Julie Fingersh can. I stroll down the sweets aisle of my neighborhood CVS like it's my own private Louvre. Good and Plenty's, avoid licorice pastels, arresting in vivid pink and gleaming white, Starburst's rainbow dazzle, waxen and yielding, Hostess Snowballs, with their tender swells of fluorescent blush coconut and marshmallow sponge, enveloping a vague notion of chocolate cake. Yes, they're made by people in lab coats. All those dyes and tinctures, that false flavoring, this faux food, and yes, jujubes rip out my fillings. But reason hath no place in the aisle of unearthly delights. Just the easy joy of becoming a girl again, as I muscle through that fierce cinnamon of the 15 hot tamales jammed in my mouth, alive with fleeting glee. This article is Great Skin at Every Age. As we're sure you've noticed, your skin changes almost as frequently as the science does. The good news? A calm, clear complexion is more achievable than ever. Today's formulas contain immensely helpful active ingredients, says New Orleans dermatologist Mary Lupo, MD. And many penetrate better because they're delivered in extended-release, encapsulated, and increasingly smaller molecules. To help you navigate this ever-evolving world, we've gathered our most enduring skincare wisdom, plus all the upgrades and updates you'll want to know about. 20s. Attention, dewy young beauties, this is the most important decade for your skin. The way you care for it now can determine how it will look for the rest of your life, because it's probably at its healthiest. With great collagen support, your skin is supple. Whatever sun damage you may have has likely not yet started to show, and light reflects off the plump surface of your cheeks, giving you a glow. The number one complaint in the 20s is pimples, says Boston dermatologist Ranilla Hirsch, MD. They can certainly be the result of acne, but are often due to using too many products, which can damage the skin's protective barrier. Treating skin gently with a few products is best. Your no-fail plan. Cleanser. Choose a mild formula that cleans without irritating, Lupo says. Our go-to is Cetaphile Hydrating Foaming Cream Cleanser. It's $15 at your drugstores. If you have breakouts, she suggests the three-step. La Roche-Posay Efacier Acne Treatment System, $34. La Roche-Posay.us, which includes a salicylic acid cleanser. Note that if acne doesn't clear up in 3 months, a dermatologist can discuss pro options. Morning steps. Focus on preventing damage. You don't need extensive wrinkle creams in your 20s, says Hirsch. Pick a moisturizer with a broad spectrum, SPF 30 or above. Apply it all over your face, neck, and chest. This is critical no matter your age. Also, it's not too soon to start using antioxidants to further neutralize UV-induced damage, Lupo says. La Roche-Posay Anti-Laos AOX Antioxidant Serum is $45, La Roche-Posay.us, and it has vitamin C. Nighttime treatment. Many derms recommend starting to retinoid, the gold standard for reducing fine lines, stimulating collagen, and treating acne, as either a prescription formula like Retin-A or an over-the-counter retinol. Avoid all forms if you're planning to become pregnant or are pregnant. We like Differin Adapalene, that's Adapalene gel. It's $15 at the drugstore. A retinoid available OTC. Before bed, smooth a pea-sized amount all over your face and right up under your eyes so it doubles as eye cream, says Hirsch. Finish with a light moisturizer like Clinique Moisture Surge 100H. It's $28 at Clinique.com. 30s. Even if you've taken good care of your skin, you may start to notice fine lines and wrinkles, especially around your eyes and mouth, says Susan Taylor, MD, professor of dermatology at Perelman School of Medicine, University of Pennsylvania. The culprits? Genetics, pollution, sun exposure, and stress. Women with darker skin tones might notice hyperpigmentation, discoloration, and unevenness. Women with lighter skin tones might see brown spots and ruddiness, and both may have acne or melasma, it's M-E-L-A-S-M-A, dark patches that can be triggered by pregnancy or medication. Skin is a bit thinner and cell turnover has begun to slow down, making your complexion look a little dull. And here's your no-fail plan. Cleanser. If skin tends to be dry, Lupo suggests a micellar water in the morning, like Garnier Skin Active Micellar Cleansing Water. It's $10.50 at drugstores, and a creamy formula at night, like Aveeno Calm and Restore Nourishing Oat Face Cleanser. It's $14 at drugstores. Morning steps. Apply a moisturizer with antioxidants to hydrate and help protect against damage-free radicals. Try Paula's Choice C5 Super Boost Moisturizer. It's $45 at paulaschoice.com. Then layer on an SPF 30 with UVA/UVB protection. A tinted formula helps block the harmful effects of visible light, which can worsen skin discoloration and melasma, Taylor says. Try Allistin Hydra Tint Pro Mineral SPF 36. It's $64, Allistin.com, or CeraVe, C-E-R-A-V-E, Hydrating Mineral Sunscreen SPF 30. It's $16 at drugstores. Next, consider an eye cream. For dark circles, look for formulas with vitamin K, retinols, kojic, K-O-J-I-C, acid, niacinamide, N-I-A-C-I-N-A-M-I-D-E, soy, or licorice. Try Istin K Ox Eyes. Istin is I-S-D-I-N. $97 at istin.com/us. If you're puffy, use one with caffeine, like Neutrogena Hydra Boost plus caffeine eye gel cream. $20 at drugstores. For the fine lines, you want peptides, says Taylor. Try Neocutis Lumiere Firm Rich. $118 at thedermstore.com. Nighttime treatment. For many, a retinoid or retinol is a great idea, says Hirsch. Skip it if you're pregnant or trying to be. Alpha hydroxy acids are also helpful for addressing dullness, Taylor says. Skin Better Science Alpha Ret Overnight Cream. It's $135 at skinbetter.com. Has retinol and glycolic acid. 40s. Those beach vacations you took in your teens may be showing up on your face in the form of blotchiness, redness, and dark spots. As a result, skin often doesn't reflect light as evenly, so it's less glowy. Hormonal changes from perimenopause can cause acne, rosacea, red patches, or broken blood vessels, regardless of your race, ethnicity, and skin type, says New Jersey dermatologist Janine Downey, MD. You're also losing more collagen, elasticity, and moisture. On the plus side, science, today's skincare can make a real difference in repairing damage, says Beverly Hills dermatologist Ava Shamban, MD. This generation can age better than anyone in history. Your no-fail plan. Cleanser. Wash with a creamy cleanser morning and night if you have rosacea, Downing suggests. Restore C Reviving Cleanser at $67 at RestoreC.com. Morning steps. Continue using a moisturizer with broad-spectrum SPF 30 or above and antioxidant serum. Luco recommends Revision Skincare C Plus Correcting Complex 30%. It's $170 at revisionskincare.com. Especially for sensitive, rosacea-prone skin, or try Beauty Star Universal C Skin Refiner Broad-Spectrum SPF 50. $85 at ulta.com. Which has vitamin C and sunscreen. If you need more moisture, apply a hyaluronic acid serum like the Inky List Hyaluronic Acid Serum. It's $10 at Sephora.com to damp skin before your other products. Nighttime treatment. A prescription retinoid is the way to go, say both Hirsch and Chambon. It can reduce brown spots, increase exfoliation and collagen production, thicken the epidermis, and potentially improve precancerous sun damage. If your skin can't tolerate a retinoid every night, you can use it every other night, or start with an OTC retinol, in addition considering a night cream that contains peptides or growth factors, which may also benefit collagen, Hirsch says, as well as hydrating humectants like hyaluronic acid and emollients like shea butter or squalane, which is S-Q-U-A-L-A-N-E. We like Skin Fix Barrier Plus Triple Lipid Peptide Cream. It's $54, Sephora.com. If your skin feels irritated or you have a rosacea or soothing gel mask like CO2 Lift Carboxy Gel Treatment, that's $93. CO2Lift.com can help, says Downey. 50 plus. Don't quit now. It's never too late to prevent new damage and stop the progression of damage you already have. Cell turnover is slower, which contributes to the biggest change you'll likely notice, dryness and loss of elasticity. Chances are expression lines no longer disappear, pores are more visible, and you've developed spider veins and age spots and possibly precancerous spots. Plus, menopause can cause a host of unwelcome changes, including acne and rosacea. Once you hit your 60s and 70s, all the issues that arose in your 50s can become more extreme. Aren't you glad you're flooded with postmenopausal zest? Your no-fail plan. Cleanser. Wash morning and night with a moisturizing cleanser. Our picks are Womanist Clean Slate. It's $22. Womanist.com. And Vintner's Daughter Active Renewal Cleanser. It's $98 at VintnersDaughter.com. Morning steps. When your face is still damp, smooth on a hydrating serum containing growth factors, peptides, or exosomes, a sophisticated technology derived from stem cells to stimulate cell activity, says Lupo, who recommends Plated Skin Science Daily Serum. It's $267 at platedskinscience.com. On top of that, layer a moisturizer if needed, and then a broad spectrum CPF 30 or above. We like Pavise, P-A-V-I-S-E, Dynamic Age Defense SPF. It's $128 at pavise.com, which also contains antioxidants. Nighttime treatment. Blend a pearl-sized dab of a prescription retinoid like Altrino, which is especially moisturizing, Lupo says. Follow with a night cream like IT Cosmetics Confidence in a Cream Anti-Aging Hydrating Moisturizer. It's $52 at itcosmetics.com. For more targeted damage, reveal, and help with acne or rosacea, consult a pro who can offer topical and oral antibiotics, prescription creams, lasers, and peels. A pulsed dye laser and the XLV laser work well to zap broken blood vessels, Downey tells us. Other layers can reduce hyperpigmentation and help blast precancerous cells. Turn the page to learn more. For even more skin care recommendations, you can go to Oprah.com. Great skin at every age. And the follow-up article on those age-related tips is What's Up, Doc? If you're considering an in-office treatment, these are the ones dermatologists deem most effective. Lasers for dark spots and uneven skin tone. Non-ablative resurfacing lasers like Clear and Brilliant and LaseMD target melasma or post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation with minimal downtime, says NYC dermatologist Daniel Belkin, MD. Skin feels sandpapery for a few days post-procedure and then looks brighter and more even. For sunspots, mild sun damage, and uneven skin texture, Belkin often turns to the PicoSure. This picosecond laser can offer more robust and long-term tone improvement. A step up from that is Fraxel or Halo lasers, leave you with a week of scaly skin, but can even out the complexion significantly, Belkin says. Fraxel can also reduce precancerous cells. After 50, the percentage of non-melanoma skin cancers increases exponentially each year, so at that point, I think of it like a teeth cleaning. It's a smart health measure, Chambon says. Note that if you're prone to melasma, hyperpigmentation, or have dark skin, it's important to go to a dermatologist with expertise in those areas. The next one is chemical peels for acne, dullness, and dark spots. Peels don't get a ton of attention, but they're wonderful workhorses and excellent bet for improving acne, radiance, and texture for most skin tones, Downey says. Generally, dermatologists recommend a course of monthly peels chosen for your skin concern and comfort level. Glycolic peels, in particular, keep skin smooth and clear and also stimulate collagen, says NY dermatologist David Colbert, MD. Next one is radiofrequency microneedling for fine lines, acne scars, and laxity. These devices, brand names include Vivace, V-I-V-A-C-E, and Morpheus 8, puncture the skin with tiny insulated needles that deliver radiofrequency energy to the dermis layer of the skin, stimulating collagen production. And after a treatment, you'll probably look like you have a sunburn for about a day. While this is not the panacea med spots often claim it to be, it's a nice, low downtime way to address texture, fine lines, and loss of firmness, Belkin says. You may see noticeable improvement in acne scars and wrinkles after a few months. Injectables for wrinkles, volume loss, crepiness, and spider veins. Neurotoxin injections, brand names include Botox, Cosmetic Xeomin, it's X-E-O-M-I-N, Dysport, Juvo, J-E-U-V-E-A-U, and the new kid on the block, Daxxify, D-A-X-X-I-F-Y, inhibit muscle movement to reduce wrinkles. While they can be a preventative measure to keep skin smooth over time, I typically suggest that when expression lines don't disappear after your face is relaxed, which can happen as early as your 20s, but more often in your mid to late 30s, Colbert says, microdoses soften forehead creases, crow's feet, lip lines, and jowls while maintaining facial movement. Another class of injectables includes hyaluronic acid fillers like Restylane and Juvederm, which restore volume in the face. I think of these as putting back the fat that's been lost with age, Colbert says. A bit here and there can lift the corners of the mouth, plump the lips, smooth under eye areas, restore cheekbones, define the jawline, and more. Sclerotherapy can address small spider veins, and biostimulants like Radiesse, R-A-D-I-E-S-S-E, Renuva, and Sculptra can create long-term volume restoration, especially for very thin, gaunt candidates in their 40s and older. And the last one is energy devices for skin tightening. Nearly all firming treatments beam energy to the deeper layers of the skin and the supporting connective tissue underneath using a handheld wand that we move across the skin, says NYC dermatologist Kenneth Howe, MD. This controlled injury causes collagen to contact and spurs more growth, making skin firmer and tighter in 3 to 6 months. Some patients seem to respond better to one form of energy more than another, Howe notes. A device called Thermage uses radio frequency technology, which is nearly painless. I tend to choose it for patients who have lax skin without a lot of heaviness or festoons, that's loose pockets of skin below the eyes. Howe says SoftWave and Altheria use microfocused ultrasound. Altheria goes deepest, so it's the best option for lifting skin, in my opinion, Belkin says. It can hurt, but Pronax, laughing gas, can help instead of sending in energy, the newest device. Elacor, E-L-L-A-C-O-R, removes tiny columns of skin. The wounds tighten skin as they heal, Howe says. Plan to do these treatments a month apart. This article is called To Her With Love. What makes the relationship between mother and daughter so fraught, so ferociously loving, so freighted with meaning, whether you speak daily or she's been dead 20 years? Four women weigh in on the wonders of this singular bond. The double-edged mother. She could be cruel and thoughtless, or magnetic and loving. Now that her mom is gone, Amanda Avutu chooses which version to remember. If I ever wondered what my mom wanted for Mother's Day, all I had to do was visit the fridge and look at the list written in her exquisite cursive she'd made for us kids. The first item, l'air du temps, or for those of us who couldn't yet read, a glossy photo of the perfume cut from a magazine. She was all want, my mother, particularly when it came to attention. For that, her hunger was insatiable. There were four of us kids, plus my dad. If one didn't give her what she desired, she'd move on to the next. If it was your turn, she'd whisper in your ear while everyone was sleeping, "Come on, let's go get some coffee." and you'd know she meant eggs and Taylor ham at the diner, and that there you'd hear some small revelatory detail about her life that she'd entrust to you and only you. In that moment, nothing else existed. Not the time she slammed you into the wall for eating leftover Chinese food in their air-conditioned bedroom. The house's only air-conditioned room, because you knew she was on a diet and the smell made her hungry. Not the time she forgot about pickup and left you at school for hours. Not the time she swore you weren't invited to the birthday party because you now suspect she just didn't feel like taking you. None of it mattered. She had chosen you, and you were magnificent. For years I tried to address these injuries, the college financial aid form she never filled out, the high-tea bridal shower she insisted on planning, during which she consoled me because she hadn't invited any of my friends, but that was impossible. She either didn't remember these events, or wouldn't allow herself to. It was like arguing with an amnesiac. The solution, it turned out, was death. At 59, my mother suffered a massive heart attack and died several weeks later. I left the hospital one night, and she still existed. I fell asleep, woke to a telephone call in my darkened bedroom, and learned she no longer did. On a rainy September day, we gathered to bury the mom who had hurt me repeatedly, deeply forgetfully. That was when my own amnesia began to lift. I remembered good things, not just the bad. I remembered the mom who taught me to add a pat of butter to tomato sauce, who befriended every waiter who served her, who made a pros and cons list with me when I was deciding which job to take after college, and who invited lonely strangers to our Thanksgiving dinners. This was the mom who put a map on her wall when I drove across the country and used colored thumbtacks to track my route, accepting my collect calls the whole way. The mom who could make me believe I was wondrous because she was looking at me, smiling, offering me an adventure. This is the mom I chose to save. In one memory, it's dark out. I have homework. I know the gas is expensive. Let's go for a drive, she says, her antidote to any pain, this time mine. She backs out of the driveway and onto the main road and throws the car into drive and cranks up. Space Odyssey. Soon, instead of houses, there are trees, then only blackness. My mom and I are hurtling through space singing. I loved her then with wild abandon, with no hurting or wanting between us. Now, every time I belt out Magic Man, like she did, or befriend my waiters, I'm choosing the best version of my mom. I conjure the best grandmother for my children. I make her magnificent. The long and binding road. It was hard for Jacqueline Mitchard, adopted daughter, to accept her new home, and even harder to accept the woman offering it. I remember exactly where I was when I first saw her face. On a cold fall afternoon, I was sitting on my bed with my laptop revising a novel when an email arrived. A friend had sent me a photo of four little girls, all Ethiopian orphans. She hoped to adopt two of them. But it was one of the others, the oldest, who drew my eye. She was the most beautiful human being I'd ever seen. She would likely never be adopted, my friend told me. She would likely be forced to support her little sister, the fourth girl in the photo, by working as a prostitute. She would likely contract AIDS and be dead before age 20. Her dad had died of AIDS, and when her birth mother saw no alternative but to surrender her children for adoption, this girl had threatened to drink bleach. She would never leave her mother, she said. She would never go to America. I tried to put the girl out of my mind, dragging the photo to my computer's trash can, then emptying it, but I could not forget her face. One day, on what I convinced myself was a mere whim, I called the adoption agency. Had anyone adopted the other two girls in the photo? No, I was told. The big sister was the problem. She was difficult. I asked, did she have special needs? No, the social worker said. She was just fierce. My husband and I had enough children, 7 to be exact, some biological and some adopted. They ranged in age from Rob, 23, to Atticus, just 3. We'd also recently had a financial catastrophe, hardly a good time to take on more responsibility. Yet I felt such longing for this fierce child. And so, 10 months later, on Christmas Day, Merritt and her little sister Marta came home to me. At first, things seemed fine. Merritt was fascinated by snow. She loved her Christmas presents. I was optimistic. I knew cross-culture adoptions could be complicated, even seen by some as wrong. But I'd done this before. What could be so different? This. Merritt hated me. In the days after her arrival, she grieved with an intensity I'd never before witnessed. She refused to eat anything except bread. All she wanted from me, she'd let me know, was an education. She told me one night as we walked to our minivan in a parking lot that she would never be an American citizen, ever. Honey, I told her, you already are. Merritt turned and kicked the side of the van, denting it. The other kids gasped. "I'm not your honey," she said. And she was not. At times I could draw Merritt to me. When I cooked, I would measure the ingredients, and unobserved she would put them into the pot. She let me take her to the skate on the frozen lake when she was absolutely unequipped and absolutely fearless. She laced up her skates and fell 40 times. We went together for swimming lessons, and at the pool she climbed the ladder to the highest diving board and jumped into the deep and straight down to the bottom, where she stayed until I hauled her up. She clung to me until we reached the edge, then pulled herself out, refusing my help, and walked away. When I read Little Women out loud for the other children, she would listen outside the door. I even took her to Orchard House in Concord, Massachusetts, and showed her the room where Louisa May Alcott wrote. I saw tears in her eyes when I told her the classic was based on the author and her own three sisters, but Merritt denied how moved she was. "It's not real," she said. "It's a story." On her first birthday in the United States, when she turned 11, we played a game, a family tradition. Each of us expressed a wish for Merritt. Then she got to voice a wish for herself. "To move to a beautiful, huge city far away from here," she said with a smile. Finally, I realized all I could do was all I could do. Nothing would ever bring us closer. A year passed this way. I think the fight was about my putting butter on her peas. She hates butter. But whatever it was, on a frigid fall evening, Merritt refused to come inside, sitting all night on the trampoline in our backyard, drinking water from the hose, telling the other kids she didn't care whether coyotes ate her. Eventually, I gave up on trying to lure her inside. I woke to find Merritt in the darkness next to my bed. I wondered whether she would hit me. Instead, she said, "Okay, I will take you as my mother." She got into the bed, and I held her, and she cried for 3 hours until she fell into sleep that lasted a night and a day. I have never struggled so mightily for a relationship, not with a lover nor a husband, not with anyone. We still rarely go a month without a verbal sparring match. And yet, of all my children, Merritt is the one I know without question would risk her life for me. Not long ago, I heard her describe the house she would build when she's grown, with 5 bedrooms, one for her and her husband, and one for her daughter, and one for her son, and one for guests. "That's only 4, someone said. "Well, one is for Mom," she said. "When Mom is an old lady, and she will live in my house." For her college essay, she wrote about my struggles to grow a lemon tree indoors, and included the lines, "I am my mother's lemon tree. I thrive where I was not planted." Pump up the volume. Molly Guy teaches her daughter the art and the necessity of sounding off. Recently, I chaperoned a field trip with my daughter's first grade class. On the school bus, the girl sitting beside my child began berating her. She called her a copycat, alleging that my daughter had sneaked a peek at her worksheet. In response, my daughter looked out the window and cried. Hard. "You should know a few things. 1, she's not a crier. 2, the girl just sat there, smug as a snake, and never said sorry. 3, I did not intervene. I thought if I did, it would make my kid look like a wimp." I know why she was crying. My daughter prides herself on doing the right thing. Being accused of breaking a rule freaks her out to the bone, so her body reacted, not her brain. It was too much for her mind to bear. At dinner that night, I said, "I know it sucks to be called a copycat, but if someone yells at you for something you didn't do, try to get brave. Breathe in slowly. Make your chest big like a lion's. Use your bold voice. Tell the girl, 'That's not true. I don't like when you talk to me like that.'" She climbed into my lap. She was listening. What happened on the bus was a small thing, but small things can become big things. Growing up, when I went to supercuts and the hairdresser put the dryer on high, burning my scalp, I never said, "Please turn that off." I was worried I'd hurt her feelings. In 8th grade, I got my period all over my jean shorts while my dad drove me to tennis camp. Instead of asking him to pull over so I could change, which required saying something uncomfortable, I showed up at orientation looking like I'd partaken in a massacre. In college, I had one-night stands in which the sex was bad, rough, painfully so. As writhing frat boys left marks on my body with their hands, I pretended I was having fun. I was a girl who kept quiet at all costs. It takes a long time to unlearn that. I don't want my daughter to go through life with sealed lips when something hurts. I don't want her to turn inward when her integrity is on the line. The next time someone tells my daughter, "You're doing it wrong," I hope she looks that person in the eye and says, "I'm doing it the way I want to do it." The next time someone hurts her feelings, I hope she says, "You hurt my feelings," and walks away. I hope she says it loudly. I hope she says what she needs to. I hope she says what I didn't. Okay, we're going to head over to the recipes section again. This is an apple fennel salad with goat cheese and pistachio pesto. The ingredients, the pistachio pesto, you need 1 1/4 cups of fresh basil leaves, 1/3 cup of shelled pistachios toasted, 1 garlic clove peeled, finely grated zest from 1 lemon, 1 tablespoon of fresh lemon juice, fine sea salt, and 1/3 cup of extra virgin olive oil. For the salad, 1 small garlic clove peeled, fine sea salt, 3 tablespoons of fresh lemon juice, 1/4 cup of extra virgin olive oil, 2 tart green apples such as Pippin or Granny Smith, 1 fennel bulb, leafy fronds trimmed, leaves from 1 bunch of dill finely chopped, 4 ounces of fresh goat cheese, flaky sea salt, and freshly ground green peppercorns. Number 1. Make the pesto. In a food processor, combine the basil, pistachios, garlic, lime, zest, lime juice, and 1/2 teaspoon of fine sea salt and process until finely chopped. Pour in the olive oil and process until mostly smooth. Taste and season with more salt. Number 2. Make the salad. Using a mortar and pestle or the side of a knife, crush the garlic and a pinch of fine salt to a paste. Transfer the garlic paste to a small bowl or keep it in the mortar and stir in the lemon juice. Let stand until the garlic mellows, about 5 minutes, then whisk in the olive oil. Number 3. Core and thinly slice the apples. Place them in a large bowl. Immediately drizzle with the dressing and toss to coat. Number 4. Slice the fennel as thinly as possible. Add the sliced fennel and dill to the bowl with the apples and toss to incorporate. Spread about 1/2 the pistachio pesto over a serving platter. Pile the apple fennel mixture on top and use your fingers to break the goat cheese into bite-sized crumbles. Scatter them over the top and toss very gently. One last time. Season the salad with a pinch or two of flaky salt and use a spoon to dollop the remaining pistachio pesto on top and finish with a few grinds of green pepper. Another recipe is pineapple chicken satay with sunshine sauce. The ingredients are 2 lemongrass stalks, 1 13.5-ounce can full-fat coconut milk, 1/4 cup of honey, 1/4 cup of fresh lime juice, 1 shallot chopped, 3 garlic cloves chopped, 1 2-inch piece fresh ginger peeled and chopped, 1 tablespoon of ground turmeric, 1 tablespoon of vegetable oil, 1/2 cup of tahini, fine sea salt, 1.5 pounds of boneless, skinless chicken thighs cut into 1-inch pieces, 1 pineapple peeled, cored, and cut into 1/2-inch cubes. Number 1. Soak 18 6-inch bamboo skewers in cool water for at least 15 minutes and line a rimmed baking sheet with aluminum foil. Number 2. Meanwhile, trim and discard all but the bottom few inches of the lemongrass stalks. Peel away the tough green layers until you reach the softer purple-white interior. Chop this coarsely and place it in a small saucepan. Pour in the coconut milk and bring it to a boil, and then remove from the heat and let steep for 10 minutes. Number 3. Transfer the lemongrass coconut milk to a blender and add the honey, lime juice, shallot, garlic, ginger, turmeric, and vegetable oil and blend until smooth. Pour all but about 1/2 cup of the mixture into a large bowl. Add the tahini to the aromatic mixture remaining in the blender and blend until smooth. Taste the sauce and season with salt and then set aside for serving. Number 4. Add the chicken, pineapple, and 1 teaspoon of salt to the aromatic mixture in the large bowl and mix well. Cover and let marinate at room temperature for 30 minutes or in the refrigerator for up to 2 days. 5. Heat a charcoal grill or oven broiler to high. Thread the chicken and pineapple onto the skewers, alternating chicken and pineapple, and place the skewers on the prepared baking sheet. Discard the marinade. Grill or place under the broiler until the chicken is cooked through. 5 to 10 minutes per side, serving with the sunshine sauce for dipping. Hey. We have some book recommendations. In the reading room section of the magazine, this first one, Memoirs Too Powerful to Put Down, Getting Out of Saigon. Getting Out of Saigon is by Ralph White. In April 1975, 27-year-old White was working as a banker in Bangkok when he received orders to close the Chase branch in Saigon. One little problem, the city was about to fall to the North Vietnamese, meaning terrible things for employees of American companies. Lucky for the 113 locals involved, White was crazy enough to think he could save them. An Edge of Your Seat, Too Insane, Not to Be True Story. Another one in the memoirs section, The Dead Are Gods by Irene Carson. That's spelled E-I-R-I-N-I-E. The author and her best friend, Larissa, were a magical pair, gorgeous, super smart black models who shared a London flat, a dazzling nightlife, and a zillion loving texts and emails. But somehow, Ernie and Noah had no idea Larissa was involved with heroin, and now she can't stop wondering how she missed it, striking a deeply resonant chord with anyone who has experienced the obsessive self-searching that often accompanies a sudden loss. In smart, stylish love stories, the first recommendation is When in Rome by Liam Callanan. Claire arrives in Rome on a work assignment and feels promptly jolted awake. The coffee is zesty, the vegetables have verve, and Claire's midlife questions about living a life of meaning feel more urgent than ever. Still, what follows Claire to the Eternal City is not just her old attraction toward the simplicity of convent life, but an old flame. Callanan's Claire is a soulful seeker, and his Rome a sensory pleasure. In that same section, we have A Romantic Comedy by Curtis Sittenfeld. Sittenfeld's latest is a love letter to a certain Saturday night sketch comedy show here called The Night Owls. For Sally Mills, being a writer on TNO is like winning the lottery every day. But when a celebrity guest host falls for her, her insecurity won't let her accept his affections. It takes a pandemic to bring her around. Packed with A1 comic banter and hilarious behind-the-scenes accounts of pitch meetings, run-throughs, and after-parties. This one is a saga, American Ending, by Mary K. Zurevlev. It's small acts of inventiveness, generosity, and love that keep individuals going when hard times close in. This is the wisdom and warmth of American Ending, which resurrects a community of immigrants from a century ago in magical living detail to tell a story that rings true in the present. Zurevlev's fiery heroine, Yelena, is especially unforgettable as she builds a life in a country that feels, by turns, inhospitable and rich with untapped promise. And in thrillers, we have The Only One Left by Riley Sager. At 17, Lenora Hope hung her sister with a rope. When Kit is hired as a caregiver for the lone survivor and prime suspect of a decades-old family massacre, she discovers that the morbid schoolyard rhyme she grew up with may not tell the whole story. Another vivid female narrator from bestseller Riley Sager, a male author with a gender-neutral pseudonym, whose signature corkscrew plots keep twisting until the lasting cutting sentence. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time. Mm-hmm.